Following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
Our guest today is Ever D. Reamer, author of Unconquerable Faith, Surviving Corregidor, Bataan, and Japan. And before you get a chance to meet Everett, I want you to imagine yourself being 16 years old, coming from a small rural town, and entering the U.S. Army for the first time, leaving the state that you've known for all of your life, having an opportunity to leave the country for the first time ever and traveling to a foreign land, only to find yourself a scant number of months later embroiled in a world war, being taken prisoner, being beaten, tortured, held as a prisoner of war throughout a number of years, one full year of which was in solitary confinement. Imagine those days, those times, those trials and challenges, and you have only the briefest glimpse of our guest today. Everett, welcome.
Thank you, sir.
Tell us a little bit about your experience and what those days were like.
Well, at age 16, of course, I had a number of my friends that were in the military, and I thought, well, I will attempt to join, which I did, and of course, I signed my father's name, and I was at a train depot collecting mail for my brother, who had a contract to deliver mail to adjacent towns. And early one morning, no one there, and I had a key to the train depot. And so I managed to get a hold of the notary that the station master had and notarized my father's name. And shortly thereafter, I appeared at Cincinnati and from there to Fort Thomas, Kentucky. And lo and behold, after being there a couple of days, my father showed up with a friend. So the friend talked my father into letting me go on, and he signed then officially stating that I was 2 years actually older than I was.
Because 18 was the legal
18
age. 18
was the legal age. And from there, I traveled by Pullman car, first class, I might add, to San Francisco, and stationed out in the bay, Fort McDowell, California, on Angel Island. Arrived there in February, and on March 31, I departed the U.S. on a transport, the U.S. Republic, USAT Republic.
How many troops were there at that time, Everett? Do you remember?
There were approximately 2,000. So,
and this was still all peacetime.
This was peacetime. This was like I said, we departed San Francisco March 31. Now, I didn't have any basic training at this point, and we boarded this ship. And most of the people that were troops ended up in the holds of the ship. I and another fellow ended up in a stateroom. And so we traveled first class to the Philippines. That was the destination that I had chosen. And so we arrived in the Philippines April 20th, 1941.
And that was how many days on board ship?
That would have been approximately 21 days.
21 days. And yeah. it's about a 19-hour flight now in
right.
this day and age.
And back in those days, of course, all you had was the, I can't think of the name of the transport, the air transport that they had back in those days. But it wasn't aircraft like we know it today.
Mm-hmm.
So from arriving at Pier 7 in the Philippines, I was taken by inner ferry over to the island of Corregidor. And there I received my basic training and was assigned to an anti-aircraft outfit, protecting a 12-inch coastal battery overlooking the South China Sea at the highest point on Corregidor.
In those days, Manila in the Philippines really was the southern Hong Kong, if you will. It really was the Pearl of the Orient after everything.
It certainly was.
And Corregidor itself sits out in the middle of the bay, really within visual distance of the mainland of the Philippines, per se.
That is true. Mm-hmm. It's midway between southern Luzon and northern Luzon. And it's approximately 3 miles. There's a three-mile channel between Bataan, which is northern Luzon, and the island of Corregidor. And approximately 4 miles from Corregidor to the southern Luzon point.
And again, Everett, that was specifically when, in 1941?
That would have been the latter part of April. May of 1941. And I completed basic training actually in the early part of June 1941.
So in June of 41, you had but about 5 more months until December 7th and December 6th in particular. And tell us a little bit about that day.
I had enjoyed leave time going into Manila occasionally between during that five-month period. And we had, basic operations, learning how to fire the anti-aircraft gun. And I happened to be a fuse range setter on a 3-inch anti-aircraft gun protecting this 12-inch coastal battery. And lo and behold, the latter part of November, we were told by our company commander that the Japanese were on the high seas and they thought that they were going to attack the Philippines. We were moved then out into the field, our field position. And so we were there the latter part of November into early part of December, and lo and behold, when the attack came on Pearl Harbor on December the 7th, we were shocked. And that same day, of course, the Japanese bombed Cavite, our naval base at Cavite, and also other areas in the Philippines.
How many men were stationed on Corregidor at that time?
At that time, there were approximately 8,000.
And I think just for our listeners, Corregidor, when we say island, it is little more than a rock after everything is said and done.
Yeah, it's 1,800 acres in area.
So on December 7th, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. The next day, literally, the same expeditionary force that had attacked Pearl Harbor came steaming into the Philippines and began attacking it in full force.
Landing. They had landed at Subic Bay and started their penetration toward Manila. And, of course, they thought that they could. MacArthur had plans, of course, to retreat into the Bataan Peninsula, which they eventually did upon Christmas Day of December 25, 1941. They started withdrawing into the Bataan Peninsula and setting up defenses.
And I know from our interviews with other survivors from that theater and from that era that with at least a partial day's notice that there were some on the Philippines that actually wanted to take a first strike capability with their air force and then begin to attack Japan. Was there any reason ever given that that wasn't done?
Well, MacArthur had our planes, and he would not give the orders for our planes to take off and bomb Formosa. Was the first major target that we thought should have been hit. But for whatever reason, and we don't know to this day why he did not follow through and order those planes to take off.
And basically the same fate that befell the airfields in Pearl Harbor befell the airfields in the Philippines as well.
That's true.
And then from December, it was a long, delaying defensive fight by the forces in the Philippines and on Corregidor to try to stave off a massive land force by the Japanese. And that continued for how long?
Well, that continued actually until April the 9th. I always look at Corregidor and Bataan. Coming into the Manila Bay area on the left was Bataan. And it was Corregidor's left flank, and we were the right flank for Bataan. And so we didn't permit the Japanese to use Manila Bay. Mm-hmm. We blocked them from the use of Manila Bay. And so it was important that one could not exist without the other. After Singapore and that had been secured by the Japanese, they brought additional troops into the Philippines, and which eventually ended up overrunning our troops on Bataan. And on April the 9th, of course, General King ordered the surrender of Bataan. And once Bataan was surrendered, Corregidor, being at a much lower elevation than Bataan, which was mountainous, the Japanese brought in heavy artillery and just bombarded Corregidor unmercifully. 1,400 shells a day was the average, plus bombing from the air. I always considered our group, the 60th Coast Artillery Anti-Aircraft, as excellent, an excellent outfit. And we did our share keeping the Japanese at high altitudes, and we shot down a number of planes. So they had a lot of respect for us on the island of Corregidor for our anti-aircraft capabilities. But once Bataan fell and the shelling started, it just obliterated the island of Corregidor. It cut all the foliage down, and it became a no-man's land after a period of time.
And it's just amazing. How many defending force on Corregidor were lost from the shelling?
Well, we didn't lose that many men. Mm-hmm. We were fortified. And but I would say we probably lost approximately 600 men.
600 men, which is just phenomenal, because for people who've traveled to the Philippines and have had the chance to tour Corregidor, it is just unbelievable with as small a landmass as it is, and for that many ordnance that fell during that period of time, why more men weren't killed, considering that the bunkers were basically reinforced concrete for its time, is just astounding.
Corregidor, we, of course, like in the, our anti-aircraft, we had trenches between the guns. And on the night that the Japanese decided that they were going to board Corregidor, come ashore, on the night of May 5, I was asked by our company commander, we had undergone a horrendous shelling that day, and I was asked to help clear the trenches between our guns. And I agreed, and I was promised a day of rest at the Battery Cheney, which was a 12-inch reinforced concrete battery. And I was looking forward to getting that day's rest. But about 1 a.m. in the morning, they came and told me that the Japanese were coming aboard and to pick up my infantry gear, which was a Browning automatic and a bandolier of hand grenades, and go to Middleside and hold up there and as backup for the 4th Marines. It was at a James Ravine area, and we were to back up the 4th Marines in case they broke through the Marine lines at this area between Bataan and Corregidor, mm-hmm. on the island of Corregidor.
And for our listeners, Corregidor sits against the waterline and goes through a series of small elevations,
right.
that at that time were known as topside, middleside. So you were halfway between the upper elevation where basically the primary barracks and command central was at that point, leading down in toward the island. Yeah. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I was stationed at in Middleside Barracks at the time during that pre-war time. So they had created a tunnel area that they had dug into the side of the hill there, and that's where we were holed up waiting to be called, of course, to back up the Marines. Had there been an invasion up James Ravine, which would have split the island in two, mm-hmm. and which never occurred, by the way.
How many days, then, from the time that you were called to possibly defend against the land forces hitting Corregidor to the time Corregidor fell?
Well, we were arrived at on the morning of May 6th at Middleside. About noon on May 6th, our company commander came and said that there had been an order to surrender the island of Corregidor to the Japanese, and we were ordered to destroy all of the ammunition and any guns that we might have, which we proceeded to do. And we stayed there through the day of May 6th, and on the morning of May 7th, the Japanese came to Middleside and took control of Middleside. We were then marched down to the west entrance to Malinda Tunnel, and there shortly after we arrived there, Wainwright, General Wainwright, was brought out with a couple of with his staff and the Japanese generals. And so he looked to the right and left, and I could see from where I was located, he had his head kind of hung down, and I could see tears on his cheeks because he saw how distraught we were by the surrender. So at that point, they had us stand in front of the west entrance and supposedly to hold up our hands for a propaganda picture. Well, I didn't hold my hands up. When I didn't hold my hands up, a Japanese guard came up with a fixed bayonet and cut my dog tags off of my neck, and they fell to the ground.
And that photo is still in existence through any number of books that we see on the history of the Second World War. I know that photo is still hanging on the wall of the Military Museum in Corregidor, and our listeners can see that photo still in your book, Unconquerable Faith. It's a dramatic photo. It's a photo that is routinely used in historical precedent over and over again. And in the middle of that mass of American soon-to-be POWs is a sandy-haired 16-year-old boy who obviously looks like he's been through quite a bit just for that period of time.
So, in a state of shock.
In a state of shock, truly. I could well imagine. So once you've been run through the propaganda mill, then where to from there?
After having my dog tags cut with a bayonet, I was in a state of shock. I could not remember how I got to the east section of Malinda Tunnel. But I had to walk through Malinda Tunnel because I remember seeing a tank up against a tank barricade on the east road entering into Malinda Tunnel. And after that, I kept walking, and there were dead bodies from the battle. You couldn't look 20 foot in any direction without seeing a dead body. And they had been there over a 24-hour period and had swollen from the heat, and the stench was horrible. And we were marched then down to an area called a holding area for the Japanese called the 92nd Garage Area. There we were corralled and without provisions for food or water for a number of days. And near the end of May, we were taken from this area and march back to the South Dock area and put on an old ship.
And then once on board ship, then where to?
We ended up being taken to Manila by rope nets down over the side into barges, and then taken to shore and dumped out into the water. Some of the guys drowned. And then we were marched down a kind of a victory parade for the Japanese down Dewey Boulevard. And the Filipinos lined the road and tried to give us food and so forth, and were beaten back occasionally. And then ended up at Bilibid Prison. Stayed overnight. I slept on the ground. No provisions for food or water still. And the following morning, we were taken to the train station there in Manila and put in boxcars, little tiny boxcars, 100 to a boxcar, and then the doors were closed on the boxcars. And we were like sardines in these small cars.
And these were like the old First World War 40 and 8 boxcars.
True.
And they got their name because you could either put 40 men or 8 horses in a boxcar comfortably, and you were packed in there 100 at a time.
100 to a boxcar.
In that heat.
And a few guys died in the process. And we ended up then at Cabana Tawan. It was raining. And we were corralled in a barbed-wired area out in an open field. And there, there was attempts made to cook some rice and so forth. And I, again, didn't get any rice. It was catch-as-catch-can.
And for listeners who've never been to the Philippines, April, May is wet season. And it's not just rain. It is just living in a cloud.
That's true. I mean,
it is just saturation. And this was after the famous Bataan Death March. Now, the forces on Bataan had already been captured, and they had been then sequestered higher in the prisons to the north at that point.
That is true.
Mm-hmm.
They ended up eventually in what was called Camp 1. But the following morning, after we arrived in Cabana Tawan, we were marched about 20 kilometers down a gravel road. to a camp called Camp Number 3. And that is actually 20 kilometers from Cabana Tawan Number 1.
Tell us a little bit about the conditions at Cabana Tawan.
Cabana Tawan was an old constabulary Filipino barracks, kind of bamboo huts with bamboo shelves for sleeping arrangements, no beds per se. The conditions were horrible, not enough food. Most had diarrhea, and I ended up with jaundice real bad during that period of time. And while there, they wanted to know what our occupation was in civilian life. And, of course, I put down that I was a cook, hoping to get next to some good food. But that did not occur. And finally, I never went out on any work details other than chopping wood there to supply the kitchen with firewood to cook the rice that we received. And there we received lugaw rice, a watery rice. And it wasn't enough to sustain one. And there we had people dying every day from starvation and disease. So eventually in October of that period, we were lined up again and taken back to Manila to Pier 7. And there we were put on an old Japanese freighter, the Totori Maru. We were among the first group to leave the Philippines. We had no idea where we were going. And midway between Formosa and Taiwan, or the Philippines, we were attacked by U.S. subs. And two torpedoes were launched at the ship that we were on, but one went aft, and I understand one went too deep under the ship.
World War II, An American Hero. Proceed now and listen to Track 2. There are three tracks to this series. Unconquerable Faith, Surviving Corregidor, Bataan, and Japan, by Everett D. Reamer. His book is available and distributed worldwide through the media publishing group of Flypaper Productions. Available in paperback for $20 and in audiobook form in a set of two CDs for $30. These prices are in U.S. currency. As part of this special podcast offer, Flypaper Productions will include media shipping and handling at no additional charge. It's important to point out that at the author's election, 100% of the proceeds from sales of Unconquerable Faith, whether it be through this podcast or otherwise, are donated to the author's local Children's Learning Center, part of a 15-state program with a mission of teaching children to read. To order your copy of Unconquerable Faith, whether it's the print edition for $20 or the audiobook version for $30, make your check payable to Flypaper Productions and mail it to our distribution center at P.O. Box 324, Harrison, Ohio, 45030, USA.